Good grief. Question everything.
Welcome. You're listening to Why, a Good Grief Network podcast with Amy Lewis Rowe and Laura Schmidt.
Today, here on the Good Grief Network podcast, we are joined by Dr. Claire Brown. And first, we would like to discuss Buddhist economics. And Dr. Brown was nice enough to send us a copy of her book, which is called Buddhist Economics, An Enlightened Approach to the Dismal Science. We are so interested, Claire, in how you think Buddhist economics and that approach applies to the Good Grief 10-Step Program. But I think before we launch into that, perhaps you could give us just a brief explanation of what Buddhist economics is and how it's different from our current economic model here in the United States.
Okay, yes. Actually, quite a few economists follow this holistic approach that I call Buddhist economics. It doesn't have to be Buddhist, but it has to be about caring for each other, caring for the planet, and also caring for the human spirit. So it's like the human spirit part especially refers pretty much to Buddhist practices. But right now, at least in the United States, less so in Europe, we have this fetish about the free market and about how keep government out, government's bad. And that means that basically it puts the rich in charge, it puts big business in charge. And it's based upon this idea that the only thing that matters is average national income. It doesn't matter how you distribute it. It just matters that income keeps growing. It ignores the climate crisis and it ignores inequality. So we end up with this model where most of the world's suffering, and in the United States, most of the people aren't witnessing sort of the beauty of our strong economy because the rich and big business take home all the growth. So we end up, and economists know this, so my book is based upon a lot of economics that is already out there, but is that, you know, really just denied by the politicians, especially the right wing. So what Buddhist economics does is it says it starts with basic truths practiced not just by Buddhists, but by ecologists, by climate scientists, and by a scientist around the world that says people are interdependent with each other and with nature. And that means all of our well-being affects each other, and the well-being of the earth affects our well-being. Then we also acknowledge impermanence, that none of us will live forever. And actually all of the process of life is continually changing and ongoing. Nothing lives forever. And then it brings in, and this part's very important, compassion. That we really, people are compassionate. People are caring for each other. So we end up seeing people not just as self-regarding. Yes, people, of course, are self-regarding. We care for ourselves and our families, but we're also altruistic. We really care for each other. People are not just selfish, as the free market model assumes. And then we really have a difference in what makes people happy. Consumption does not make people happy. The psychologists have shown that. The neuroscientists have shown that. What makes people happy are our relationships, are working together to create the communities and the kind of world that we want to live in. What really makes us happy is enjoying nature, living meaningful lives. And so we always need to just ask ourselves, what makes me happy? What is really meaningful, important to me? And then we focus on that, both individually, but also collectively.
Wow, thank you for that. And so what I'm thinking as I hear you say this is it almost sounds too good to be true, because it sounds like a win-win for everyone. And so my question then is, what keeps something like Buddhist economics from catching on?
Well, the biggest problem has been well documented, that there's big money ruling politics. And so we have the Koch brothers who've spent literally millions and millions of dollars taking over politics at the local levels, so the state level, and the national level. So we have this dark money, as it's called. then we also have the problem that once dark money is taken over, they start suppressing voting rights so that a lot of people aren't even allowed to vote, even though they've even tried to vote, and their vote can be thrown out, or they can be sent away at the polls. So we have this problem where big money is ruling politics, and politics is ruling the economy. So instead of the government and taking care of energy and moving us or transitioning us, as Obama was doing, to clean energy, we now have big oil and big coal in charge of energy, in charge of public lands, and really making things much, much worse, both for the climate, but also for people. We have this problem that when you put big business and the rich in charge, you're going to make sure that everything works for them, but not for the rest of us. So I see it as a big political problem, but that doesn't mean it has to be that way.
Yeah, thank you for that insight. I'm moved by the notion of inequality and how wide our inequality gap is right now here in this country. And it seems like Buddhist economics really wants to appeal to bridging that gap. And I think what's inherent in our current capitalist paradigm is that the free market economists, well, and you even say this, free market economists assume that inequality is required in order to provide incentives for people to work hard and be rewarded for their contribution to the economy. And it seems that by nature of this current economic paradigm, we are promoting inequality, almost as if inequality seems to inherently exist. But your model is saying we can bridge that gap, we can make things better. Can you speak to that a little bit more?
Yes, I think this is so important because economists have known and have shown how to get rid of inequality. Nobel laureate Joe Stiglitz has a book. Tony Atkinson, the UK expert, has another book. And in both of those, they say countries choose their inequality. Countries don't have to have inequality. Let me just go turn off that phone. I'm so sorry. One second, okay? Okay, my apologies. I forgot about the phone problem. It hardly ever rings, but it won't ring again. I got rid of it. Okay, sorry.
No worries.
Okay, so we're talking about, okay, inequality, how we're told by Nobel laureates and experts on inequality that countries choose their level of inequality by their tax system, by their social programs, by the way they structure their markets. So we don't have to have inequality, and actually, the U.S. is an outlier. We have some of the world's worst inequality among the rich nations, the European nations, for example. Their inequality is much worse. Our well-being is also much worse as a result of that. So we know the problem is not an economic problem. Economists can tell you there are a myriad of programs that we should be using to share prosperity, to give workers power, to really provide good health care and education and well-being to young people, to really help students get the higher education without enormous loans, how to actually ensure good jobs and as worker power is a part of that in the job market, how to ensure healthy retirement incomes. We know how to do those things, but in the U.S., we've been going in the opposite direction. So it's been a problem. Our inequality has really skyrocketed since the 80s when Ronald Reagan started reducing progressive taxes. And the reports, the quote you gave from my book then goes on to say, but actually every single economic test of how much do we have to give incentives for people to work hard and be creative, the answer is it doesn't have to be a very big incentive. It's like hardly for any incentive at all, people really will want to work hard and do well and prosper, but they want everyone else to be doing well and prospering too. It's like the free market is like a win-loss idea. Oh, you're going to do better, then I'm going to have to lose. But the Buddhist economic model is it's win-win. We can all do better together. And it's not because beating up on each other really isn't making anyone happy. So we had that, but let me just say one of the things, Lauren, Amy, that have bothered me is I worked on inequality also for decades since the 80s, along with colleagues at Berkeley and MIT. and Harvard, and we know the policies to share prosperity, and we learned a lot actually from looking at the Northern European countries, and we really know a lot about what works, but the politicians ignored us. So I really have felt that our work on inequality as economists was a total failure. It's like we didn't do anything. We didn't really get the job done, as inequality just got worse and worse and worse. So we have this additional problem. We have a huge inequality problem, but we also have the climate crisis occurring. And I've looked at my colleagues working in this area where I spend most of my time now working on the climate crisis, which is related to inequality. I say, we can't fail this time. We really can't fail this time. We've got to do better. We have to acknowledge the political side of it, that it's really a political problem as well as an economic problem.
Yeah, it is for sure. And I want to ask you about how we overcome this political problem and the big money and dark money in politics. How do we see this really in existing in the world when we feel like these superpowers are just too powerful to overcome?
Well, I think we've started overcoming them, thank goodness. Don't you think that? You can see and look at people are getting much more active in politics. Look at all the women we elected. Look at all the Democrats we elected.
Yeah.
And then also, to the Koch brothers' dismay, ActBlue was able to raise more money than the Koch brothers raised from the rich. By ActBlue went out and raised money by millions of people making small contributions to progressive candidates, to get the vote out, to really try and re-engage people in the political process. So it's like even now we have found a way that when Obama had started it getting small donors, but it wasn't an infrastructure. But now ActBlue has provided an infrastructure where people can give money to candidates all over the country and to progressive causes. And that made a huge difference in the last election. And one thing I heard from the Koch brothers was, you know what, we've got to figure out how to kill ActBlue and everything they're doing. Like, whoops.
Yeah.
Well, first and foremost, I would like to say, and it almost feels like a confession, I made it out of my public education never having taken an economics class. And this is a topic that has intimidated me for quite some time. And I think making it an accessible conversation in the way that you have and making it about issues we care about, and economics kind of always felt like for people who had money in my head. And it's actually, as your book points out, relevant to everything we do. And so I just want to say thank you. First off, reading your book gave me hope, and it empowered me to realize that I do know some things about economics, just not in the way that I thought. And I think same thing with what we're seeing in politics. People have been, they've lost their power, and empowering people. First, people have to understand that their voice matters, and kind of all of that on the individual level. And so your book really excites me just for that reason. And so that's not a question. I've resisted the topic of economics for most of my adult life. And so thank you for speaking about these issues in a way that's accessible to those of us doing this work, because it's an important way to have resources and power. And so I'm grateful and thank you from the bottom of my heart.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. Thank you for reading my book. It's like, okay, because I did want people who never had studied economics to read my book and not be scared of economics. But I could tell that you knew a lot of economics, because when y'all look at the Good Grief Network, it's actually Buddhist economics in action in my mind. It's like, okay, the complementarity is so powerful between your 10 steps and Buddhist economics.
Yeah, thank you.
So my next question for you is this possible to implement Buddhist economics on a worldwide scale? And are there examples of these policies that already exist and share prosperity to use clean energy and reduce global suffering that are already in the world?
Right. So we have all the policies. They're in place. And that's a great question. Like, where are they actually being done simultaneously? So I have a group of students at UC Berkeley who have spent the year creating we started calling it a Buddhist Economics Policy Index of creating the policies that one would need to create this kind of economy. But we changed the name just because Buddhist economics sometimes puts people off. So, because they're not Buddhist or they're not economist or whatever. So we call it now the Sustainable Shared Prosperity Policy Index to see where is it happening, to what degree is it happening. And so we bring together sustainability, sharing prosperity, and playing a world role in reducing suffering. And lo and behold, there are some countries who are doing quite well. As you might imagine, they're all in Europe. But it's not just Sweden and Finland and Norway. Yeah, they do well. But also Germany and France are doing well. And then it rolls on down the list. The U.S., we have 43 countries, which are mainly the industrialized, richer countries. And the U.S. out of the 43 is like it's in the mid-20s. It's like way down the list.
Yeah.
Although we should be at the top of the list. We could be. We have the resources, we know the policies, we have the economists ready to do it, we have the political scientists ready to do it, and now we're electing people that are trying to get ready to do it. I think the New Green Deal is reflecting how, in the United States, they would create a Buddhist economy.
Yeah, and that was just announced, the outline for it was announced today, and we're recording this on February 6th, I think, 7th, 6th. We're recording this on February 7th.
Okay.
Thank you for all of this insight. I would love to pick your brain about all of these specifics. And unfortunately for the podcast, we don't have a lot of time to do that. And so, again, I recommend that all of our listeners read Buddhist Economics, An Enlightened Approach to the Dismal Science. As we discussed earlier, it's really approachable. It's a text that's a couple hundred pages. Dr. Brown has done an excellent job of making these things digestible and understandable for a wide range of folks who may not think that they can tackle economics or these sorts of big questions that we have. So if any of this sparks your interest, I would definitely recommend picking up the book. We read it over a couple weeks. We just read a chapter or half a chapter a night, and we've been really blown away, which is why we're talking to Dr. Brown right now. My next question, again, I want to get way more in depth than the time allots. One of the things that I'm really interested in, and I think you do a good job at the end of your book, highlighting some pragmatic approaches for nation states, for companies, and for each of us to pursue. But I want to hear from you on what steps do we need to take as individuals and as a culture to make this transition occur quickly? As you've mentioned, you know, the inequality gap and climate change are two of our most fundamental problems right now, and we need to deal with them in some sense of urgency. So could you share with our listeners about what we as individuals and the bigger culture needs to do to make this happen sooner than later?
You know, I think a great place for your listeners to start is your 10 steps, because I put it down as two steps for individuals. But one is living a meaningful life with awareness, with caring for others, with contributing to family, community, relieving suffering wherever possible. But you go through the 10 steps that are very specific about ways people can do that. And that's sort of like the first eight of your steps. It's sort of at the individual awareness of who am I? What, you know, how can I live a meaningful life? How can I get off the consumption treadmill? How can I really engage with others and with my community in a way that I feel better and I feel good and I'm, you know, helping to live a life with meaning for me and the people around me? So those are your first eight steps, which
yep.
I really agree with. Then the second step in for me, when I say individuals, is you got to get off the sofa. You got to get out. You got to join up with others to create change that is actually essential right now. As you said, we've got to do it quickly. We have like 10 to 12 years to really get off of fossil fuels and our addiction to fossil fuels. And to do that, we really need to push governments to do it at the local level, state level, and national level. So I, for example, lobby a lot in California to the bill we passed this year was a huge step forward to get to 100% clean electricity by 2045. Because once you have clean electricity, then you electrify everything, your homes, your industry, your vehicles, your transportation. And so that's a really big step. And of course, fossil fuel, big oil, hated it. Lots of people that were in industries that had to change fought back, but the people won. People came from all over California to Sacramento and made sure it passed because we knew what an important step it was to stop emitting carbon dioxide and methane. So that was really important to me, but that's a really important step in Buddhist economics for individuals. And for you, it's under your action steps 9 and 10. So, and I think you all do this wonderful job. What I really like, because I also think it's critical that everybody just step back and say, but what can I do? And anytime I talk to someone and sort of talk about their experiences, their education, their talents, what they do well, that everybody has a talent, everybody has experience that they can contribute when they're in a group. So you have to be in a group. I work with 350 Bay Area, but other, it can be your garden club, it can be your schools, your kids' school, it can be any group that you share their values and you all really want to make a change to create both a sustainable world and a world with shared prosperity and a world that supports meaningful lives. So that's our goal. We all have this goal, and you don't have to do it all. You just have to do one thing, because there are millions of us. There are millions of us that are active, smart, bright, energetic. And when we work together, like for example, and when I'm with the team, these people are so smart. They have medical capabilities, public health. They have political capabilities. They have all these capabilities that I am clueless. I have no idea. But I know economics, and whatever they are thinking, I can always add sort of the economic part of it. And they're saying, oh, wow, we never thought of that. And I think, well, good. See, I could add something that helps the group. But everybody's doing that. And so together, the synergy is astonishing. So I say, you know, and you only have to pick one thing you're passionate, care about, and work on it. So that's a really big deal to me, is taking action and doing it with others.
Thank you. We appreciate your linkage to the Good Grief 10-Step Program. And we really resonate with what you're saying about how each of us has a skill or a talent. And when we combine in community, lots of things can emerge. Lots of solutions can emerge. And particularly, I think Amy and I are really interested in more out-of-the-box thinking. I think it's Albert Einstein who says we can't solve the problems with the same thinking that got us into the problems to begin with. and so there's a lot of power in community, and a lot of power in dialogue, and a lot of power in the inspiration that comes together when each of us really shows up with our authentic self and really wants to commit to a sort of change. Even if we as individuals can't understand what that change might look like, you know, coming together in community really eases that anxiety, because it's not up to you to solve everything. Everyone gets to have a say in the world that we would like to live in and what it might look like moving forward. So I really appreciate your insight and perspective on taking action and the importance of getting off of that sofa and really making a change and making a difference in the ways that you as an individual can.
That's right. And also, as you point out in your Good Grief Network, it really helps us feel much better and to feel healthier and to deal in a way with the climate crisis that doesn't defeat us. Because otherwise, I know too many people are just so down and out. I said, you know, you need to go out and work with others. And when people do that, they always go back, oh my gosh, you're right. That's exactly how I needed to deal with my sort of hurt feelings, my depression, my lack of energy. Because it really energizes you, as you know, to go out and work with people. So can we add one more thing to that equation? Yeah, I agree with you. One of the things I love is when you work with people who have all these different experiences and ideas, you really do think outside the box. But one more thing that you get from working with a group is courage.
Yes.
We actually have to have a lot of courage. I live near a Chevron refining plant. I've done a lot of work on trying to make that safer for our community, especially the people who live near to it and to suffer horrible health problems and asthma and so forth. And these Chevron people, they're actually quite mean and vicious. They really couldn't care less about the health problems they're causing. And they actually are willing to lie. So as an economist, as a professor, I make sure I have the data right and I have whatever information we can pull together that's evidence-based and go and we say, okay, here's the problem. Here's what we think you need to do. Here's the kind of air pollution that's coming from your factory. Here's how it's hurting the community. And they just like are mean and nasty. And they really do want to do anything they can to get us to shut up and to try and make us look stupid. And so it takes a lot of courage. But you have the courage when you're with a group of well-meaning, intentioned, you know, well-minded people who really care. And many of them are being hurt directly. And so that gives you a lot of courage. And sometimes we win. Sometimes we wish we had done better because Chevron does have a lot of power. But the main thing is that we're in it together. We're never alone in fighting against the air pollution that they're creating in our community. And that's just one example. But we need courage in lots of ways.
Well, and Dr. Brown, I'm very grateful because I feel like a lot of what's happening right now is part of the culture that is awake and wants change. You know, we feel it and we show up for the burning rallies. We show up for the climate marches. We show up for the women's marches. We started with Occupy Wall Street because we know that something is not right. And what I like about your work is that you give us a pragmatic response. You give us a way to really invest our time and energy into a vision. Somebody in one of our group meetings last night said, well, we can't always be fighting for something. We have to also stand for something. And I think that was really powerful because I know with a lot of us that feel this unrest and, you know, we don't want to be living in this inequality. We don't want to be committed to this massive climate change behemoth that we can't maybe fight. But those are all things we don't want, you know, and your book really provides things that we do want. You know, we want equality. We want everyone to have a fair chance at life and equal opportunities. We want people to have access to food. We want people to feel connected. We want to mitigate the worst impacts of climate change together. And so I'm really, really grateful that your body of work has some approaches that we can take and we can form a vision from that instead of, you know, wandering around visionless.
That's right. And now with the new Green Deal, we can really talk about it and really think about how would we get these, we know a lot of different policies, which one would work for in the United States at the state level, the local, whatever, but we can now have a really important discussion and engagement of bringing people together to talk about, okay, what are the policies we really need to create the world the way we want it to be? And we actually need it to be now with sustainability that shares prosperity and also keeps us caring for each other.
Well, and I have another question for you, and that is, could you explain in short what the new Green Deal is proposing? As Amy and I are not economists, we have a layperson's view, but I would love to hear the things you're excited about or what the new Green Deal entails.
Well, what I'm excited about is that it says, yes, we absolutely have to tackle the climate crisis. We have to do it immediately. If we have, like in 10 years, we need to really get to net neutrality on carbon emissions. So that's really number one, and that's the green part. But the New Deal part is to say, but just a second, to do that, we really do care what's happening to people. We really do care that they're good jobs and that people have access to good jobs. That we really do care about reducing inequality. And so they don't have specific, well, they have a few what could become specific programs, but they want to, for example, to do a lot of the things that we've even mentioned briefly, like tuition-free higher education, for example. Healthcare for all. Yes, of course. good and better education for everyone from an early age all the way through high school and then college. So what we're trying to do is to think, okay, what are the policies that actually take care of kids, that provide well-being for kids? And then once people get out of their educational process and are in the labor market, how do we have good jobs for all? How do we empower workers at the workplace? And so that we can really take back this idea that big business dictates everything at the workplace and workers are just pawns in a game where wages haven't risen for decades. And then we take it to the third step of retirement. Okay, how do we support people and care for people after they've done working and they retire? And then help problems or even caring for people being lonely and isolated. So the New Green Deal is trying to bring together all of these things, and I actually think of that as Buddhist economics in action also. And we have to see it unfold because it's going to take a lot of policies. There's no silver bullets anywhere. We have to really work hard, as you say, bring in all the members of the community to see how would it work? How would it make work for everybody to feel included and to be better off? And to be honest, part of it in the U.S. is to really reduce our carbon footprint. Our carbon footprint in the United States is like 4 times what the U.N. benchmark is per person. So yes, we really do need to figure out how to dramatically reduce our carbon footprint in this country. We're way above Europe, and Europe has a very good quality of life. So we don't need to have the carbon footprint we have in the U.S.
Yeah, I think this sounds great, and I think that I'm on board. But I can also hear my conservative friends saying, well, how are we going to pay for all these programs? Is this socialism? Are we going to end up starving half our population trying to make something like this work? And so how do we appeal to the critics or to those who are very conservative and don't want a lot of government action involved here? What would be your response to that?
Well, it's absolutely true that the role of government is much bigger. It's not socialism. I mean, it's social democracy, but actually social democracy is a hybrid system. It's a market system with a lot of government structuring or regulating of the markets, plus government programs, social programs to provide well-being for health, education, and the things that we all need that the market doesn't provide well. So it's what I think of as a hybrid system. It's not free market, it's not socialism. And all the political scientists will explain that to you. They'll explain, look, every market is structured. There's no such thing as an unstructured market. The question is, who's going to structure it? Is big business or the rich, are they going to structure it so they take home most of the goodies? Or is a government that's democratically elected and all of us, are we going to structure it in a way that has the goals of well-being for all people, for caring for the planet? So first of all, get them involved in what's important to you. Oh, well, what kind of social programs do we need for that? And then secondly, you say to them, you know, right now, Bloomberg and others have shown us the cost of not getting rid of fossil fuels. The cost is enormous. It is so much higher than any of the costs we're talking about in the New Green Deal. We're talking about like a third of GDP, a third of global assets just disappearing because of the climate crisis. And so every single good economic analysis I've seen said that business as usual is going to cost us a whole lot more than tackling climate crisis and tackling the inequality that actually is causing a lot of the climate crisis. So every single analysis I've seen, and I put some of them in my book and then on my website I try and add updates, but every single economic analysis says business as usual cost enormous amounts of money that we can't afford. So let's create the economy that we actually can afford and would help everyone be better off in terms of their well-being, in terms of their happiness, in terms of their health and education.
Thank you for that. And so this might be a bit of a curveball, but in my mind it seems related, so I'm just going to ask. So I wrote down from your website the quote about traditional economics measures the ways in which we spend our income and doesn't attribute worth to the crucial human interactions that give our lives meaning. And that word worth, I think, is really telling there. And I'm wondering if this relates to needing a new system or how. So we haven't given value to the things that do bring us meaning in our lives. And for instance, I can remember growing up feeling guilty if I did something positive to take care of myself, like went for a walk instead of doing homework, or we've kind of like, if it doesn't have financial value somehow or directly related to financial value, we haven't given it the same sort of worth. I guess I'm coming back to that word worth there. And so do we need a new model to help us imagine these things, do you suspect? Or do you think that just by understanding their different types of value, that is enough? I'd love to hear your thoughts further on that, if you're willing.
Right. Yeah, no, that's a great question, because it's really at the heart of Buddhist economics. So one of the things that every economist will agree on is we need to measure the economic performance differently than just people's income, work, capital, whatever. We need to get outside of just the marketplace. And Bob Kennedy said it beautifully in the 60s about how we're measuring everything about the marketplace, but nothing about what we care about and what makes life meaningful and valuable. And economists agree with that. We have lots of different measures, and in my book, Chapter 6 goes over them, sort of here are different ways people look at it and how we might do it. And I actually have done a lot of work on the genuine progress indicator. And that's just one way of doing it. Everybody agree who's an economist, any way is better than the way we're doing it, which is we just focus on market outcomes. And the other problem is we don't even look at the distribution of earnings and income. We just take the national average income when we compare countries. It's like, what? So our average income could be going up in the U.S. as it has, but it's going up just at the top and not we're the bottom 95%. And that means it looks like we're all better off, but in fact, we're not. So the problem, too, though, is this way of looking at focusing on market outcome and on income really upsets us. Just as you said, I love that, hey, if I'm focusing just on my income and materialism and consumption, I'm just in this rat race of working, 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 and not asking what's important to me, what's meaningful to me, you know, how can I create a life that I feel really good about for me and my family and my community. So we need to, first of all, measure economic performance differently, measure and focus it on well-being. And then once we do that, we really do have to then say, oh, what are the policies that improve well-being and for people and the planet? And so you segue immediately into focusing on well-being. And we have a great study that came out of the UK that said, you know, actually, well-being of the population on all different kinds of scores goes up when inequality goes down. So sort of national well-being and inequality are really tied together. And so once we focus on well-being, all of a sudden we start making changes and we start focusing on what are the government policies that actually provide well-being for the planet, for the people.
Well, and your book does an excellent job of explaining why GDP falls short and showing us some models of things that already exist or that are being thought about that can incorporate well-being and personal worth and planetary worth, ecosystem worth. Your book does a great job of laying that out in a way that's digestible and relatively easy for a layperson to understand these very complex ideas and models. So thank you for doing that.
You're just so kind. Thank you. Thank you for enjoying but understanding my book.
Yeah, well, trying to. I'm not, you know, I'm not sure we 100% understand it, but it definitely got us thinking and influenced our way of seeing the world. And it gave us, it prepared us for a discussion on why GDP is not the measurement we should be going after, and where it falls short and things like that. And for me, that was really helpful because I have taken a few economics courses, particularly in college. And it was environmental economics, and that's where we learned about externalities and how our current model doesn't fit in externalities. And so then, you know, those expenses get pushed off into the population. And so I have a little bit of knowledge about economics, but this just, it gives us a vision. And then it also tells us why our current vision isn't working. And for me, that's huge. And I think right there, that's enough to want to read it for many of us.
Yes, thank you, because you're right. When we ignore externalities, when we ignore the climate crisis and pollution, it's like, what? It's like we aren't even including that in any of our analysis of economic growth and sort of what's the economy actually doing. So, yeah, you nailed it on the head there. We know that. But we also know that the way we're looking at it, we're ignoring inequality. And so the climate crisis continues, inequality gets worse, and we're saying, just a second, we have to totally rethink our metrics, how do we measure it, but also how are we, what are the policies we need to create the world we want?
I also just wanted to be sure to add that I am grateful. For me, this book it feels like a point of connection, because we were just talking the other day about how facts are not changing minds. You have to appeal to people at their values. And when folks challenge some of our perspective based on an economic or financial model, I just kind of used to say, oh, these people and I have different values. We don't know how to connect. We don't want the same things. But your book is helping me see that, oh, we can include these people in the dialogue. This is how. It's giving me the tools to kind of bridge that gap a little, and that's what I think makes it so revolutionary, and we're grateful.
Thank you. Thank you so much, because I think it's right. We can find ways to connect together, because after all, we all are interdependent, right? With my well-being and everyone else's well-being goes together. Can I just read you how I end my book? Because I end my book on courage. How important,
yes, absolutely.
How important courage is for all of us. To embrace and practice Buddhist economics, you need courage. Courage to change, courage to promote the environment, courage to promote justice, and courage to live with joy. At the personal level, you need courage to quit the rat race of overworking to make more money, courage to live mindfully as you help others, and courage to enjoy life off the materialistic treadmill. At the national level, you need courage to demand that your government provide the infrastructure needed for an economy that protects the environment and reduces carbon emissions, one that defines economic growth as improved well-being for everyone rather than just more income. We also need the political will and courage to take action for ourselves on behalf of all species and future generations. So it's also something that is never ending. It's a lifetime commitment and process. One of the things I love about our discussion and about what your network is doing, it just shows how big all these groups are, how many of us there are, and how we all are working together and we are creating change. Even though the world is deeply out of balance right now, the change is happening. And as you point out, we need to make it happen as quickly as possible, but at least the change is happening. And I really feel together we can make it happen even faster, and it's going to happen faster and faster, because it's really, I see the awakening all around me in people getting motivated, caring, really want to live differently and to live in a way that's good for all of us.
Yes.
And yeah, so I think you all are doing a great job in your network of reaching out.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Why, a Good Grief Network podcast with your hosts, Amy Lewis Rowe and Laura Schmidt.
We hope you've enjoyed this episode and come back next time while we dig into difficult questions during these predicament-laden times. If you like what you hear, please consider supporting us on Patreon. You can find us under Good Grief Network. We hope you have a great day filled with meaning and joy. Thank you for listening.